Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring the stories that make the incredible world of tech and venture tick. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to the founders, investors, and ecosystem operators trying to make a dent in the future. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, it is really great to have with me Leo Ringer. Leo is founding partner at Form Ventures, a seed stage fund backing startups in markets shaped by regulation and policy. Prior to launching Form, Leo spent time at the Confederation of British Industry, the CBI, as head of financial and fiscal policy, was an economic advisor to Vince Cable, at the time Secretary of State for the Department for Business, Innovation and Skills, after which he joined Global Council, a strategic advisory firm co-founded by Peter Mandelson, as head of UK. Leo, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you with us today.
Great to be here. Really excited for it.
Amazing. So let's jump straight in. You've had quite the resume. Can you talk us through your journey and what prompted you to move back out of public sector policy and into that most capitalistic of sectors, VC?
Yeah, it's probably a pretty unusual journey for people starting venture funds. And I think that speaks to what we're trying to do with Form, which is build something that's very much a VC fund, but with a twist, which is this focus on our kind of professional heritage, I suppose, which is the public policy world. And I've seen throughout my career, initially, as you said, as a sort of a lobbyist at the UK kind of private sector trade body, then in government, seeing that interface with business and policy, and then in an advisory context, just how kind of important this bit that sits between venture, tech, and kind of government is. And, you know, that's really baked into the DNA of Form. It's in my professional background. It's partly in my co-founder's background as well. And the way we've hired and built the team at Form is it's really embedded. And it's where we think we can kind of earn our edge and get our edge in a sort of increasingly competitive market at pre-seed and seed. But for me, it was by the time I started Form in sort of late 2018 with Patrick, it felt very obvious, but I appreciate kind of, if you look at my CV, it's a pretty unobvious route. But the one thread that's common throughout is I've always sat at that interface between business and sort of politics and seen it from every different angle. And running a venture fund is sort of the latest angle to that kind of experience, if you like.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think what's really interesting to me is the move from public to private sounded like, you know, when you and I talked in the past, it sounded like it was relatively seamless, and it kind of made sense as that next step to circle the square, as you say, between those two kind of quite disparate sectors. But at Form, you know, you're investing in companies where public policy or regulation could be a factor, which goes beyond what most would understand as reg tech, right? Like, I mean, reg tech and legal tech tend to be the kind of most talked about areas within this sort of wider realm. Can you talk through what that means in practice? Because presumably that could be a very broad selection of ventures that fall under that definition, right?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's one we had a lot when we were fundraising and pitching this initially. And it's one that founders ask us now. So the way we think about it is we're actually pretty generalist software focused investors, like the majority of pre-seed and seed funds that operate in, you know, for us in the UK. I think the best way to think about our thesis is that we particularly focus the value we bring to founders on helping them understand and navigate public policy, regulation, government in the broadest sense. And bringing that to the table is our way of answering the question, well, why should we take your money? Why are you relevant? How do you sort of earn your seat at the table? Because we're building Form for a world in which founders increasingly have choice between funds, and they rightly have kind of choice. They're picking their investors as much as investors are picking them. And we have to, you know, just as they're pitching us and selling us on their proposition, if we're interested in that, then it becomes incumbent on us to pitch them and sell them our proposition and have a very clear value add. And so the best way to think about our thesis is that's where we try and add value. It also speaks, therefore, to the kind of companies we back. So while we're pretty generalist in what we look at, the more obvious sectors that are of interest and where policy and regulation play more of a role, the three at the moment we think most about are probably sort of fintech and insurtech and financial services in the broader sense, where I think it's pretty obvious to anyone who's founded or invested in that sector that kind of policy and regulation matters, whether you like it or not. Another one would be digital health, again, in the broader sense, including mental health, where, you know, policy can really be quite nuanced. Maybe it's about approving a medical device, but it might be about public sector procurement and working with the NHS. And there's a whole spectrum of issues there that are relevant. And the third one that we see a lot of deals in and we're interested in is the whole climate space. And that itself is hugely broad. But if you think about most of the business models, whether software or kind of software enabled and kind of going into hardware, there's almost always a regulatory angle there, whether it's around the funding of carbon capture and storage, or whether it's in, we're invested in a company called Silvera, who are becoming the ratings agency for carbon offsets. And that's a space where policy is hugely relevant. So I think we have this natural tendency towards business models where public policy and regulation are going to matter at some point. But ultimately, we're not looking to optimize for that in the companies we choose. What we're optimizing for is those that are going to be, you know, transformational huge businesses, but where we think we can add a particular value. And that's, I think, the best way of thinking about the thesis. And so RegTech and GovTech and LegalTech, as you say, they're all part of that for sure, but they're relatively minor parts of what we see as a much wider sort of surface area for our thesis.
So let's talk about that edge for a second, right? So I completely understand broadening the church to include and capture businesses that will have or will be impacted potentially by regulation down the track. And obviously, as you say, fintech, climate and health tech are all very clear examples of where that's likely. Is the value add then that you then bring, is it your understanding of the regulatory landscape? Is your ability to lobby government or other regulatory bodies? Or how do you add that value? Because again, that is quite broad, right? So I would assume would not necessarily have, you know, deep hooks into the regulatory bodies for all three of those sectors as an example, because they are very disparate and very diverse sectors. So how do you provide that edge to founders that are taking investment from you?
Yeah, it's again a great question. And again, one we had to unpack for potential investors in our funds. So I think the first observation we made about both founders and kind of VCs in the market is it this whole space tends to be one, and this is a bit of a blanket statement, but it tends to be one where pre-existing knowledge and networks, you know, aren't as strong as they are in other domains. Lots of founders, lots of VCs are very strong on the vision, on the product, on hiring and, you know, go to market and a bunch of other disciplines that you need to get right as a successful startup. The policy and regulatory space just felt to us like it was much less well served and much less well understood. And so I guess the first bit of the answer to the question is to come in and add value and to be helpful, we think is building on a relatively low base. And that's, there are some founders who are brilliant at this and investors who are brilliant on this, but in general, the bar has been a bit lower in this area than it is in some other areas. I think if we came into the market and said, we're going to be the fund that know everything about kind of go to market, like I wouldn't back ourselves to pull that off, right? Because a lot of people are very, very good on those issues. The second point is that I think a lot of what we find ourselves doing for founders is really that translation piece between what government's doing and what they're doing. And really trying to say, look, these guys are kind of defining the playing field in which you compete and operate, whether it's rules or funding or regulation, whatever it may be. So just like any other variable in your business, how do you optimize kind of around that? How do you say, in light of knowing about that, what are the decisions that we take? So one example might be from our portfolio, a company taking on the cultivated meat or cellular agriculture space. Well, if we know the latest thinking within government about where the regulation of cultivated meat is going to be in novel foods, then we can make some decisions, some pretty critical early decisions about how we do our science, which take us down potentially different regulatory pathways. And so really all we're doing there is using our network and our insight into government and playing back for founders useful intel that contributes to the decisions they're making, you know, the pretty big calls early on. And so it's really that translation piece, I think, that is core. Yes, to a degree, we might think about then trying to kind of get them in front of people in government and push on policy where we think that matters. We're doing that a little bit in the childcare space, but I actually think that most founders recognize that policy change is a long-term game. It takes years. And we're very cautious to sort of say to founders, we're not going to come in and suddenly magic all the rules away for you or change the rules in your favor. And I think that's kind of maybe a bit more of a US style approach to lobbying and policy. That isn't really, it's not really how the UK and the European kind of jurisdictions work. So we're quite cautious to set expectations about changing rules, but we use our network and our insight to help them make the best decisions they can make early on when those decisions are really important. And we've got a whole spectrum of examples from our portfolio that speak to that. And I think the proof is in the pudding, right? So I think if you picked up the phone to the founders we've backed so far, they'd all say, yeah, no, it's been super helpful. And we'd have form around the table again. And that's ultimately, that's really the KPI for us on that side of our business. You know, we think about our founders as one of our customer groups. And if they come back and say, you said you were going to add this value, you delivered on it, and we kind of vouch for that, then that for us is success. And that might look very different for different companies, but ultimately, you know, put them on the spot. What would they say? You know, have we kind of been good for what we said we were? And that's what we try and focus on.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, one of the things you said there that I think really summed it up was the translation between what public policy is saying or doing or the direction it's going in and what that means in terms of your business. Because, you know, if you think about most founders and most sort of ventures, they will have limited information. It's almost always asymmetric in terms of founders and VCs. Certainly founders and government, I would assume, would be even more asymmetric. And therefore, you know, having any kind of edge that gives them some ability to see around the corner or get an insight into how a particular department or minister is thinking is going to be massively valuable. I mean, I think you and I in the past talked a little bit about, you know, cannabis legislation or lack thereof, maybe, certainly in terms of medicine and where that's heading, you know, therapeutics, etc. Like for people that are potentially launching in that industry, I would imagine actually having someone who has a deep understanding of how government thinks and works and operates maybe around that space, and obviously this could fall very much into your health tech sort of domain, I would imagine would be very, very, very important. And in fact, actually, I think if you are operating in those spaces, you know, in the UK, whether it's cannabis or whether it's other regulated sort of industries, it's nigh on impossible to really do anything without having some information like that. So I think that makes a lot of sense. Look, in December 2020, you wrote a piece in Sifted about the need to soften regulation around companies' ability to exit via sale. And one of the things I found incredibly interesting is that in Europe, companies founded pre-2010 accounted for more than 33% of venture capital raised in 2020, i.e., you know, companies that were 10 years old were raised over a third of the money that was raised via venture capital was raised by companies that are over 10 years old. Do you think any progress has been made in the 12 months since you wrote that piece? I mean, what can be done to encourage policymakers to look at antitrust through a different lens? And I appreciate that both in the US and the UK and Europe, we are heading down some fairly sort of interesting paths over the coming years, and some have already been trodden.
Yeah, it's a good question, because I wrote that from the perspective of seeing, I mean, look, the elongation of companies staying private for longer, taking longer to get to exit, is that's a structural feature of, I think, the venture market kind of globally. It speaks to a whole bunch of things, and policy is, you know, one of the, I think, one driver of that, but I wouldn't want to claim that it's by any means, you know, the most important. But what I was really arguing was that certainly in the UK we have this sort of strange thing going on where policymakers are desperate for companies to list here, and we make a big deal about, you know, who listed in the UK, or oh, we lost them, they went and listed on the NASDAQ, and then Deliveroo being, I guess, the example of a listing that has happened since I wrote that piece, and where, you know, the UK institutional buy side was pretty skeptical initially, and there's lots of commentary around, is the UK a place to list an IPO? But the government, at least, has always been kind of really fixated on this as being almost the validation of the UK as a tech ecosystem. Like, are companies choosing to list here? Is London the preeminent place? And kind of like, fine, I understand that. And I think that's a healthy conversation and a healthy focus for government. But on the other side of sort of exit, if you like, which is companies being acquired rather than listing, it's the complete opposite. It's this real obsession with the idea that big startups are being snapped up by bigger players or taking investment that's anti-competitive, and we need to sort of stop this and get in the way, and government needs to kind of put itself between acquirers and sellers and scrutinize deals more heavily. And this is something that I think this is a bit curious, that there's this sort of inbuilt preference for, you know, you can exit by IPO, but if you're going to say it, don't get bought. And my concern there is that there's a challenge for kind of liquidity in the ecosystem, because those exits feed back through and those entrepreneurs do other things. And it's a kind of flywheel that, frankly, we haven't really had much of in Europe yet, and we need, and is a big part of the flywheel of venture in the US. And so I guess my advice or my insight was, we just need to be a little bit cautious before we start toughening up both competition policy rules, but also increasingly the national security investment rules, which are going to start screening deals more heavily on those grounds, all of which basically reduces the number of companies that can successfully kind of exit via sale. Have things changed in the last 12 months? No, if anything, they've toughened up, because that national security legislation has progressed. We have a much more robust sort of ex-ante regulatory regime coming in for tech in the UK, particularly on the big guys, saying if you're Google, we're going to look at you, and we're going to look at deals you might do, you know, before they're done. It's a much more proactive approach. So for me, you know, we're still sliding in that direction. And the broader point, I think, is that we see some people in government who have a good understanding of the venture ecosystem, but I think a lot of policymakers don't, because frankly, they've never been exposed to it, and it's not a judgment on their professional competence, but there's just been a really, really poor degree of interaction between the tech community, the venture community, and public policymakers in general, across departments, across regulators. And one of the things we try and do at Form and try and do increasingly is bring those two sides together and just say, hey, look, if you guys spent more time over here and you guys spent more time over here, then everyone has a kind of mutual understanding of the two different sides of the coin. And actually that might shape the way you think about public policy. So it's something for the UK to think about, something for Europe to think about, but I don't think we're going to have that flywheel effect going on until we kind of slightly neutralize the policy playing field towards the two sort of types of exit. Not everyone can IPO, not everyone will IPO. No, they won't always do it in London.
Yeah, I mean, we've had both Hussein Kanji as well as Neil Shah on the podcast in the past. So Hussein and Hoxton Ventures were early investors in Deliveroo, and Neil Shah works with the London Stock Exchange Group. And they've had some heated sort of exchanges on Twitter around this question around IPOs in the UK versus elsewhere. And I don't wish to recreate that debate here, but I think it is an ongoing question that needs to be answered. Equally, there are a couple of sort of situations that spring to mind from recent past, which I think support your argument that the regulatory regime is still maybe a little bit more heavy-handed than it needs to be or should be. We had Patrick Ryan on the podcast recently, and you know, whilst he's building his own startup at the moment, he worked at Crowdcube a few years ago. And obviously we had recently, I think it was 2020, maybe 2021, the attempt to merge Crowdcube and Cedars, which was blocked for antitrust reasons. But actually, you know, if you think about the competitive landscape of who the competition for those two businesses are, it is every venture capital fund, every angel, you know, it is this rich ecosystem funding. So that made not a lot of sense to me. And then the second one that sprung to mind is the more recent case of Arm and Nvidia, which, you know, I'm not sure that completely fell apart just purely because of regulatory concerns, but I believe that was potentially part of it. And of course, now they are pursuing an IPO. And obviously Arm, from the perspective of the UK, is one of its success stories. But to kind of tie its hands behind its back and say, well, no, we don't want you to exit to Nvidia, would, you know, has actually driven them, I think, if I'm not mistaken, again, to look at listing in the US as opposed to the UK. So again, we kind of lose out from that perspective. So look, you started talking about raising a fund back in 2018 with your partner, Patrick Newton. You raised a very small pilot fund in 2019. But it wasn't until September last year, 2021, that you closed Fund 2. So could you talk us through the challenges as a first-time fund manager in the UK? It's something I've talked to quite a lot of US emerging managers about. And, you know, it seems to be, if not an easier process, certainly a more accepted kind of process and launch pad, if you like. Whereas in the UK, we don't seem to have that same attitude or even ability for people looking to raise a small fund for the first time to get going. So it'd be great to understand what your experience of that was. And as I say, what the challenges were.
Yeah, I mean, it's a question of how long have you got? It's not easy, and it wasn't easy. And I think looking back on it, kind of had we known how hard it was going to be, people have asked me the question, kind of, would you have done it again? And you know, I don't know. I'm not quite sure I know the answer to that. But it's nice to sit here now and reflect on it. But it was really, really demanding. I mean, just to run you briefly through this sort of sequencing, we talked about this sort of mid-2018, convinced ourselves with a lot of testing in the market that it was a good idea. By early 2019, we said to our bosses, look, we want to run this. And they were both very good and let us do it as a side hustle. So we stepped back to do part-time day jobs and get this going. So kind of spring through summer 2019, we raised that little pilot fund one, as you say. And we had the benefit of launching that on AngelList, who at the time were running their venture funds product in Europe and have since unfortunately stepped back from doing that. But it was really helpful for us as a kind of launch pad, you know, plug and play fund, bring some capital and we'll do the back office. And that was great. And I think essential for us at the time. And then we began investing in October 19. And by summer 2020, we thought, okay, this is going okay. We need to jump in with both feet. You know, we're doing this part time, it's going well, but if we want to raise this fund too, we need to be really serious about this and look LPs in the eye when we're pitching them and say, this is our only gig and we're all in. And so that was painful. We weren't earning any money. And then it was just over another year before we closed the fund. And to be perfectly candid, one of the main questions we had in our mind was how long can we keep at this before we have to pull stumps and say, hey, you know, we're going to have to go back and, you know, we've both got young families, mortgages, you know, the whole shebang. So for me, reflecting on it, it was really tough. And I think there's a few things that kind of come out as learnings for other managers or things I think are challenges in the UK emerging manager and in fact the European emerging manager ecosystem. One of them is that I think tolerance for like thin track record is so much lower than it is in the US. In the US, if you have maybe some operator expertise or some domain expertise and a good strategy and you can convince people, then that can be enough to get going with smaller funds and get that sort of, maybe it's a few million or 5 million, or, you know, you get newsletter writers pivoting into writing funds because they build a community. So I think we don't have that kind of on-ramp here in the UK or Europe for like pivoting from something where you built credibility in an adjacent space and then leveraging that in a small fund vehicle, because there isn't the LP base here yet that are willing to write those maybe sort of almost like angel style LP tickets into emerging managers. And that actually goes back to the point we had earlier about exiting founders. It's often those exited founders that are the ones that back, you know, the next emerging managers or go on to raise funds themselves. So that kind of mini flywheel, I think, isn't there yet. The second one is access to capital. And we were, you know, we have very privileged backgrounds in lots of ways, but we didn't come from a network of knowing lots of wealth and LPs and having a kind of community to tap up. So we were starting from scratch in that respect, which again it's just really hard, because a lot of emerging managers, it's a real help if you can tap a few people on the shoulder and say, are you good for a bit? And then, you know, you build it there. But we were starting from a low base. I think a lot of emerging managers are, and there's no reason why people with good ideas about fund strategies happen to be the people with existing wealth networks. And I think, again, until we kind of chip away at that. The more simple point as well, which is just operationally and informationally, it's hard to know how to start a fund. There's a load of content out there about raising from VCs, how to pitch VCs, who they are, what they want, how to do a pitch deck. Pitching LPs, what's the fund, the back end, the insurance, the fund ops, the mechanics, portfolio construction. You know, that this was like, you know, incredibly hard to assemble a good understanding of what that was like and what market looked like and what was common for managers. And that's just a question of kind of more resources needing to be out there. We can reduce that informational barrier, then we can get more people thinking they can do this. But at the moment, I think the lack of understanding about what it takes just puts people off kind of straight up. And then back to the point about not earning money, there's just a question of needing a bit of savings essentially to fund yourself through the inevitable longish fundraising pipeline. And that's, I don't know kind of what the answer to that is. I think there must be innovative financial products there around, could there be a fund that backs managers and takes a bit of carry if they succeed in raising a fund? I don't know, but surviving through that kind of personal runway is really tough. And any emerging manager will tell you the same thing. It takes double the amount of time you thought. And so there's a bunch of those structural reasons why it's hard. And I think the upshot of that is we don't have a very thick pipeline of new emerging managers coming to market, where basically you get into market on the strength of you and your idea. I think it's still tied to other things like network and personal wealth, which it shouldn't be. And that then rolls forward into a question about diversity in the ecosystem, because I think while we're very aware of the lack of diversity about who's getting funded at the startup level by VCs, actually at the manager level, diversity is even worse. And that's because it's even harder to crack that industry from the outside. And so for me, the fully solving the diversity question, not solving the question, but improving the status quo, means a step change at the manager and LP level, as well as at the startup level. And so that's a real challenge. But yeah, it was tough. We got there, but you know, there were many times when we thought we wouldn't, and it came close. And there were days you wake up and you think we're never going to get there. And I think, again, just we try and be open about that, because I think a lot of VCs don't talk too much about what fundraising was like, but telling people it was tough and being open about it, I think just hopefully increases the number of people out there that might think about it and just, you know, have a bit more of an insight into what it's like.
Yeah, look, I mean, we've had a number of previously emerged fund managers, let's call them, as well as currently emerging fund managers. And the story has been the same from everyone, you know, whether it was Hussein again, who, you know, talked about it taking 3 years to raise fund one at Hoxton back in the day, which is ludicrously long, or Samir Ann Kasim or Priya Oberoi, who are emerging fund managers here with Pink Salt Ventures or Goddess Gaia Ventures. I think the things that they kind of touched upon, which again echo a lot of what you just said, was, you know, you need that cornerstone, or having that cornerstone makes life a lot easier, because again, we all know that investing is somewhat a kind of a herd game. So if there is someone who has cornerstoned your fund, it's that much easier to then convince other LPs, but also it gives you that comfort that, as you say, that actually we can do this. And again, that there is some capital there behind you. And the second thing was, again, about the opaqueness, right? So I think one of the things that I discussed with Samira was exactly that, that there is no operating playbook for how to set up a fund. It's something that I've been very curious about for the last several years, or certainly the last couple of years, and it doesn't seem to have been made any less opaque. I think one of the things that has happened, you mentioned AngelList there, and as you say, their fund product is no longer available in Europe, and there are some companies coming to fill that gap here, you know, companies like Vauban or like Odin, who are both setting, you know, allowing you to set up relatively cheap containers for SPVs, but also for fund management. And I think exactly to your point, the more we can democratize LPs access to diverse managers and diverse LPs accessing diverse fund managers, and then down the chain, until we get to that stage, you're still going to see that lack of diversity throughout the ecosystem. So I think being transparent about it is exactly the right thing to do. And I think, you know, we're in a place, you know, in 2022 where it is better to be transparent and humble than it is to kind of, you know, cloak yourself in hubris, because for most people, this is not a path that they could consider taking and probably, you know, would have to think very hard about. But the more people like you that are willing to talk about their journey and the process, you know, the more informed we all are and the more informed people can be about making that choice. So look, at Form, beyond the regulatory angle, what are the main things that you're looking for in a venture? Is it team? Is it tech? Is it traction? Or is it something else altogether?
Yeah. So obviously the answer is a bit of all of those, but we invest at pre-seed and seed. We're UK only at the moment. But as I said, we're relatively generalist, you know, software focused. We look at and consider bits of sort of hardware, but it's primarily software or software enabled. And I think the answer that pretty much every pre-seed and seed investor would give you is that team is probably the thing we come back to most often. You know, we have to believe that the founding team wants to and is capable of building a really big business. As you'll know well, the kind of slightly crazy economics of venture mean that the model we run means we have to believe every company we back is capable of returning a fund, which means that, you know, to sort of the man in the street, a very, very large outcome. So that's what we're sort of, you know, in the parlance, we're underwriting to. So ultimately, do we think that team have the conviction, the kind of courage, the ambition, the capability of doing that? And that doesn't just mean them, but their ability to then bring absolutely top people around them as they grow and scale, because that founding team, you know, needs to expand over time. And so that is sort of, in a sense, one of the most important judgments, but it's also one of the most, it's one we can't, you know, compromise on. We don't mind seeing companies well pre-revenue and kind of at an idea stage. We'll do tickets down to sort of 200K and participate in small early rounds if we believe in the idea, the market, the team. And so we don't say you need to have launched and have revenue, and we invest behind that. But we invest later as well. Our maximum ticket would be about $1 million into rounds of up to, say, 5 million. And there's sort of more kind of, I call them mature seed rounds, where there's some revenue on the table. So it's not just all about the early stuff. And as I said, to a degree, there's always a regulatory element, but we're not optimizing that. We're not trying to find the companies with the most interesting policy challenges. Actually, if policy is sort of maybe going to pop up and be an issue a bit later on, and we think we can be helpful, great. But actually, if it's not going to be massively material all the time, then that's fine. If we still think that, you know, the team is building a really interesting company, taking on a really interesting market, that's, you know, we're a VC fund. We're here to return a multiple of capital to our investors at the end of the day, and we think we can add a lot of value on the way. But that's what we're shooting for. As I said, the kind of the areas we see most in at the moment, lots of fintech, lots of healthcare. I'd say that if you look at the deals we've done out of Fund 2 so far, so we're kind of coming up to closing our third deal, they're actually all sort of in the enterprise B2B space. We have done consumer deals and will continue to, but I think that's where we're just seeing more interesting opportunity at the moment. But I'd encourage any founder thinking about us to have a look at our portfolio, have a look at our website. We explain kind of where we invest, pitch us. We don't at all require or need warm intros. We're fully of the belief that it's in our interest to see as many companies as possible and to be as accessible as possible. So we have a kind of fairly transparent 2-minute pitch form on our website that pumps straight into our deal flow pipeline, and we get back to everyone who applies through that form, whether we invest or not. So, you know, we try and take our obligation to founders seriously, and we let them decide if we're a fit, and hopefully they think we are. But ultimately, we're led by the quality of the team, the quality of the opportunity, and everything else kind of falls into place around that.
Yeah, you're not wrong. Every single investor that we had on the podcast has always come back to indexing for the team. I think the important thing is, you know, a lot of people think about it solely as, well, you know, who is the founder or who are the founders. But it is, as you said, it's their ability to attract that really incredible talent around them as they scale, which is just as important as the quality of the founder themselves. And I think often, you know, the mistake that people maybe make is that, like, a great founder can attract great talent. They can if they're very visionary, but often, like, if they are, you know, if they're a little raw, if they're a little green, it doesn't matter how good the business kind of model or idea is. If you don't have the right founder in place at that initial stage, it's very hard to kind of attract the talent to go alongside it. So look, finally, as we're kind of winding up, Nothing Ventured is all about the bias I have, certainly, towards the entrepreneurial spirit. How well understood is the entrepreneurial, or certainly the venture playing field, understood by policymakers? Because beyond things like SEIS or EIS, tax efficiency or Innovate UK, like, what more can government do to ensure we have a world-beating, and I hate using that phrase, but I thought I'd throw it in there, a world-beating early-stage ecosystem?
There's loads to do in a sense. Like, and we think about this a lot at Form. Not so kind of one half of our brain is focused on our portfolio and the specific regulatory issues they have and helping them through that. The other half is focused on these more, as you say, these more cross-cutting issues. And the ones that are absolutely core are access to capital. And so that does mean, you know, a really good early stage sort of tax and investment ecosystem. So yes, SEIS and EIS are helpful, but one example there is they didn't really work with non-priced equity rounds, right? We've had this discussion before about can we have a sort of safe style document that is more EIS and SEIS friendly? And, you know, that's a long-running debate and lots of nuances. So there's instincts in government expand thresholds there. And so there is a piece around that. We're the beneficiaries through the British Business Bank of the sort of fund-to-fund level kind of approach there, which I think is a really healthy one. But again, I think actually, you know, we're doing a £30 million fund, and that's probably at the lowest end of what the government would now back. So is there room for a scheme beforehand that picks up our earlier discussion about that kind of on-ramp for managers that is government going down the stack and saying, okay, you want to do a £5 million fund? Well, that's good for the ecosystem. So let's find a way of helping managers do that with some, you know, with some public backing maybe. So I think there's plenty on the sort of access to capital side that we can still do. Having said that, I think the UK regulatory approach there is pretty good, and there are people in the Treasury that understand that, maybe less so at HMRC, if I'm being honest, on the tax side. The other one is access to sort of talent and people. And I think whatever your views on Brexit, the question of the UK's immigration policy has been a big one for the last few years. And I think most people in the tech ecosystem would prefer a more open and sort of attractive, not just in terms of the rules, but the tone of voice around the UK being welcoming to talent, I think is as important. The government's made good steps, things like the global talent visa. There are ways now of companies bringing in talent when they need it, and that is improving slowly. But I think we've taken a step back overall in the last few years on, is London a place you want to come and start and join a business? And then on the kind of the broader regulatory side, I think this is where there's probably most work to do, which is the companies we see are taking on massive important markets, like mental health, or, you know, feeding people in the future, or childcare. And the problem or the challenge there is those issues are housed in bits of government which don't often see much of the tech world. So Treasury and the guys thinking about tax release, sure, and the immigration teams at Home Office, you know, they hear a lot from the tech community about what they want. I don't think the childcare team in the DfE had ever had a conversation about tech, you know, before we sort of started that conversation with them. And, you know, say the mental health team at Department of Health, you know, these are regulators who come from a different world. And so I think this goes back to the point about bringing the two closer together. Yes, it's the cross-cutting stuff. I mean, data would be another one, data policy, data adequacy. But these vertical areas of sectoral policy, they're the real critical ones. So can we have a medical device regime that allows software devices to be approved, but then updated over time, and the regulation they don't have to reapprove each time they change the code a little bit, right? So, but I don't think anyone at the MHRA has sort of sat down and thought hard about that. It's not that they wouldn't if they thought about it, but it's just that no one's brought that to them, because I think the tech community has had its channels in the government and the regulators have had their channels outwards, but we want to kind of make that much richer, a much richer discussion. And so for me, yes, access to capital, there's some tweaks. Yes, access to people, there's improvement. But on the regulatory policy side, giving, you know, officials within departments, within regulators, the kind of permission, the risk appetite to go out and meet startups, take a little bit of measured risk in the way they make rules, embed the idea of promoting innovation and competition in what their setups do, as well as keep customers safe and consumers safe. These are the things that I think actually they sound really nerdy and really bitty and kind of down in the weeds, and they kind of are, and they're not particularly sexy, but actually in the way we see potential transformation in industries, that's where I think the mileage is, and that's where we spend, you know, quite a lot of our time.
Yeah, I mean, that really comes down to, transparency and discourse, right? And making sure that two-way conversation is happening in the right manner. And I think, you know, to take your point around migration, it's not just about the policy, it's about the attitude and the perception, I guess, of the policy, if not the policy itself, right? If the UK is seen to be, you know, the so-called hostile environment, then that's obviously going to stop people from potentially applying to come in. Currently, obviously, without sort of minimizing what's happening in Eastern Europe and Ukraine at the moment, you know, the UK's sort of relatively poor attitude to bringing, or not relatively, very poor attitude to bringing refugees into the country from Ukraine will not have gone unnoticed by the tech community in Eastern Europe, which is in a large part supporting a lot of the great businesses that, that founders are building here in the UK as well, because the access to incredible talent at reduced sort of costs is, has been, you know, very much part of the ecosystem, borrowing that talent from, you know, Ukraine, Lithuania and elsewhere, Estonia and so on. So I think all of those things are massively important. Leo, it's been absolutely incredible. It's such a pleasure to have you here talking to me today. For our listeners, where's the best place for them to look for you? Are you online? Are you on Twitter? Are you on LinkedIn? Where can they find you online?
Yeah, Twitter at Leo Ringer. I have the benefit of having an unusual name, so that's easy. And for founders, our website, formventures.vc. And then if you add /pitch, you get a form. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to see a deck. As I said, we'll come back to you either way. So do reach out if you want to just have a chat. If you think we're not a fit, or we might be as well before applying, just drop us a line. So yeah, I'd encourage anyone to reach out to me or the rest of the team. There's four of us now. Going back to the earlier point, we've invested behind our policy capability. We've invested behind our ability to kind of see more deals. So we'd love to hear from anyone and everyone.
Amazing. Leo, thank you so much. I really appreciate you having come on to chat with us today.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. Follow us on social and at nothingventured.tech to make sure you never miss another episode. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can support us by giving us 5 stars on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. We love to hear from our listeners to understand the topics and guests that they'd like to hear about and from most. Drop us a message via the links in the show notes, and thanks again for your support.